From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Barack Obama talked big in his first campaign for the presidency on tackling climate change. In his first term, some environmentalists were disappointed. Congress was resistant. Yesterday, in an impassioned speech, President Obama said it is time to move.
As a president, as a father, and as an American, I'm here to say we need to act.
Behind that call, a big new package of steps on climate change the president says he is prepared to take without Congress. Executive action on climate change. Potent, controversial, and the president says urgent. This hour on point, the president's new climate change push, what he's proposing, where it would take us. Let's listen to a little bit of the president yesterday. This is in the baking sun, sweltering really, at Georgetown University. The president outlining the signs that climate change, he says, is happening rapidly.
Our planet is changing in ways that will have profound impacts on all of humankind. The 12 warmest years in recorded history have all come in the last 15 years. Last year, temperatures in some areas of the ocean reached record highs, and ice in the Arctic shrank to its smallest size on record, faster than most models had predicted it would. These are facts.
And the president said he was no longer willing to wait on a just say no to the idea of climate change block.
I'm open to all sorts of new ideas, maybe better ideas, to make sure that we deal with climate change in a way that promotes jobs and growth. Nobody has a monopoly on what is a very hard problem, but I don't have much patience for anyone who denies that this challenge is real. We don't have time for a meeting of the Flat Earth Society.
And his answer yesterday, executive measures through the EPA and more to change the carbon emission profile.
The idea of setting higher pollution standards for our power plants is not new. It's just time for Washington to catch up with the rest of the country. And that's what we intend to do.
Changing the parameters for power plants, including existing power plants. Plenty of steps here. The president outlined yesterday. Plenty of resistance certain to come. We're diving into all of it right now. Joining me first today from Washington is Coral Davenport, energy and environment correspondent for the National Journal. Coral Davenport, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
In the, in the array of steps this president has taken slash proposed on climate change, how big was yesterday, Coral?
Yesterday was huge. But really, there's one central step that we'll see. He talked about a lot of smaller steps, but as you mentioned, the biggest one is going to be EPA regulations on existing coal-fired power plants. Existing coal-fired power plants are the biggest source of carbon pollution in the U.S. They're also a major part of the U.S. energy landscape, of the U.S. energy economy. Putting forth those regulations is going to that's the biggest thing that this government can do with executive action to make a difference on climate change. It's probably going to have a profound economic impact as well.
Let's look first just at the numbers. What portion of American energy comes out of extant coal-fired power plants? Do you know?
I do. Actually, what's interesting is that it has declined over the last several years, but right now it's about 40%. So that's still obviously a huge sector of the U.S. electricity supply.
And what is the president proposing? We know that the details remain to be worked out, but in general, what would this have to mean to bring down? Of course, coal means lots of CO2 emissions, or at least traditionally has. Is he talking about building very expensive clean coal plants or just corking up those pipes and getting off of coal? What?
So we're going to have to wait to see exactly what the regulation says. I think this is going to be one of the most challenging regulations, economic, environmental regulations to write at all. I would not want to be a lawyer at an EPA charged with figuring out how to do this. The president said that the draft of this regulation will come out a year from now, June 2014, and that they want to have a final proposal by June 2015. But essentially what it will say is it will require existing coal plants to cut their emissions by some amount. We don't know. The regulators can figure out how much they want to do. We won't know whether this will be sort of a top-down Washington-centric mandate. It's possible that they will write the rule in such a way where they give states the ability to make the decision how they're going to do that. They'll give each state they'll say each state needs to lower their emissions by a certain point, and then state regulators can figure out, well, will we do this by shutting coal plants? Will we create a market-based system? All of that lies ahead to be figured out.
Broadly speaking, and when environmentalists and people in the energy industry look at this, does it likely mean shutting down or cleaning up those coal-fired plants?
Right now, the president has been given a real gift by the free market that he didn't really do anything to deserve, but it just kind of happened naturally, which is that there's been a big boom in production of domestic natural gas. Natural gas is the second largest source of U.S. electricity. As it happens, it produces only half the carbon pollution of coal. And right now it's being produced because there's this big boom at about equal or even a little bit lower price than coal. So what we're probably going to see is just a market shift over the coming years as electric utilities know these rules are coming. They'll probably start retiring their old coal plants and just shifting to natural gas plants. If the price of natural gas stays low, this will be a big change in the U.S. energy mix. That may happen without hurting consumers too much, but environmentalists will point out that market shift won't be enough all on its own to get us where we need to go in terms of, you know, all the emissions that we need to see cut.
We'll look at what that would entail. Even before the president gave his speech, Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky went right after this as an attack on coal, which he described as an attack on jobs.
Declaring a war on coal is tantamount to declaring a war on jobs. It's tantamount to kicking the ladder out from beneath the feet of many Americans struggling in today's economy.
Carl Davenport, what about the economic impact of what the president, again, is broadly proposing here?
Well, again, it's interesting because a lot of these coal plants will probably be retired, but on the other hand, we'll probably see construction of a lot of new natural gas plants. So, in terms of the overall numbers, we may just see a shift from coal jobs to natural gas jobs.
You're saying even without the president doing anything, Mitch McConnell's coal country was in trouble?
It really was, and that's actually due to the forces of the free market. We saw in the 2012 campaign, the coal industry, really waged this attack against the president, saying he was declaring war on coal. They spent a lot of money, went all out in coal country, Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Virginia. It didn't really work. The president was reelected in all the key swing states that have coal. Interestingly, I looked this up yesterday. There's only 84,000 jobs in coal mining in the U.S., according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. What we'll see as a result of these regulations is that those mining jobs probably will be hurt and they probably will go down. But that's a very small sector of the American economy, and we're likely to see growth in jobs coming from the natural gas sector. So, coal just doesn't have the kind of the numbers, the political clout that it used to have to fight back on this.
We're going to come back and look in depth at what this would mean on power energy production in this country. What about the other major elements here? Part of this looks abroad. Part of it looks to alternative energy in this country. What's he proposing, Coral?
So alternative energy in this country, this is kind of continuing along the same path that we've seen the administration go along already, which is a push to develop renewable energy on public lands, wind and solar on public lands. There's also a big push. There will be a big effort for climate change resiliency and adaptation. A lot of the damages of climate change are already baked in because, as you mentioned, we've already kind of hit a point of 400 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. There's some stuff that's going to happen no matter what.
So toughening up our infrastructure to deal with rougher weather ahead.
Yes, building levees and dams and, you know, preparing infrastructure, especially in coastal cities, for tougher weather to come. So we'll see a big expenditure and push on adaptation and preparing for what's to come.
Overall emissions reduction goal here of 17% by 2020, not long from now, compared with the level in 2005. What's the consensus? If the package of things that he laid out yesterday were deployed, does it look like it might achieve that goal, Coral?
Environmentalists say we may need to see a little more, but this is going to be, we can't get, these steps will be necessary as a first step to get there. Probably there will be need to be more bigger changes in the economy as well. But environmentalists essentially say this is an essential first step. More will be needed, but you can build a lot on this foundation.
And the president really stretching here on the Clean Air Act as the background for his executive authority. What about legal challenges just bottling the president up, not the coal plants necessarily? What about the odds that this just never flies because of legal challenges?
This is going to be a huge legal challenge. The Clean Air Act was written in 1970 and it was updated again in 1990. But actually, I have talked to a lot of the folks who wrote the Clean Air Act and also wrote the updates of the Clean Air Act. And they say, you know, when we wrote this, we weren't thinking about climate change. We were thinking about problems like acid rain, like soot, smog.
And now here we are, climate change right in our laps. Coral Davenport, pardon me, but we've got a break right here. Please stand by there in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the president's big new push on climate change, what he's proposing, where it would take us. Coral Davenport is with us from the National Journal. Joe Rome and David Kreutzer join us in just a moment here. Here's President Obama talking about other pollutants that are already regulated and saying it's time to turn those sites, that power, on carbon emissions.
We limit the amount of toxic chemicals like mercury and sulfur and arsenic in our air or our water, but power plants can still dump unlimited amounts of carbon pollution into the air for free. That's not right, that's not safe, and it needs to stop.
Don't stop it with regulations, some in the energy industry and related said in an interview yesterday with the Associated Press. Jack Girard, president of the American Petroleum Institute, said the president's push to regulate power plant emissions, not needed.
Regulatory activities which we believe are unnecessary because carbon releases in the United States today are going down primarily due to the use of clean burning natural gas.
Let natural gas, cleaner natural gas, take care of it. And in coal country, not happy. In an interview with Fox News yesterday after the speech, Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia said the White House can't disrupt the coal industry while also depending on it. Here talking about the EIA, the Energy Information Administration.
The EIA, which is part of the Energy Department for this president and this administration, basically says they're depending upon coal well up until 2040. 35% to 37%. Why do you want to shoot yourself in both feet and then try to run the marathon tomorrow?
Don't knock coal out of the picture, says Senator Joe Manchin there. Carol Davenport, please stand by with us right now as well. From Washington, David Kreutzer. He's a research fellow in energy economics and climate change at the Heritage Foundation. David Kreutzer, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And from Washington, Joe Rome, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, editor of their blog, Climate Progress. He worked in energy in the Clinton administration. Joe Rome, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Go to Democrat Joe Manchin's argument right there. He says, look, the administration's own people say that as late as 2040, 35% to 37% of our energy may be need to be satisfied by coal, and the president puts that in jeopardy here. What do you say to that, Joe?
Well, the International Energy Agency is merely projecting what will happen if we don't do anything. The Energy Information Administration doesn't ask the question, what should we do to protect human health and welfare? What should we do to deliver a livable climate to our children? So you know, I think the president made the key argument, which is that we have a moral responsibility to act to stop destroying a livable climate. In a perfect world, there would have been a climate bill a few years ago that, you know, didn't use the EPA's regulatory authority, but, you know, conservatives killed that. So since we have to reduce carbon pollution to preserve a livable climate for our children, and the Supreme Court ruled that the EPA has to regulate carbon pollution if it harms human health and welfare, which it obviously does, then we have to act. So I think the president took the prudent course of action. You know, I think we probably will still be using some coal in 10 or 20 or 30 years. And if the industry were smart, then instead of fighting regulations and fighting efforts to develop clean coal technology, the industry would actually embrace this, because ultimately 30, 40, 50 years from now, we're going to have very low carbon pollution. And if we don't have a way of capturing carbon and storing it, then the coal industry will just be shooting itself in the foot.
There's lots of talk of shooting in the foot here, Jerome. Thanks for that. David Kreutzer, what about all this? What do you think of the president's path on carbon emissions here, climate and climate change with or without the package that he's outlining, the economy if he gets his way, and the impact there?
Look, if we had warming leading to ever-increasing hurricanes, which we don't, it's flat. If we had warming weather leading to more tornadoes, which we don't, it's flat. If we had the warmer weather associated with more droughts and floods, which we don't, and if you could get rid of the carbon by creating jobs and having a positive impact on the economy, then this would be a no-brainer. Unfortunately, all of those things are the other way around. We don't have upward trends in weather. People say, well, for the rougher weather ahead, we simply don't have those trends. We have models that say that will happen. But it will be a significant hit on the economy. We used a code from the Energy Information Administration's energy model at Heritage to produce a study that will come out tomorrow. And if we cut coal back by 75% by 2030, it's going to have a significant impact on the economy. And I will point out that 75% represents about 30% of total electricity. If we do that, renewables will fill the gap by 1.4 of those 30%. What's really going to happen is we're going to have a whole shift from natural gas. We'll take up most of that gap, and then we'll simply do without some electricity. That's going to drive natural gas prices up 42%. That's going to have a really significant impact on manufacturing. The war on coal has a lot of collateral damage. It's not just the 84,000 coal miners that Coral was talking about.
David Kreutzer, can we go back to your premise there? I just want to understand what you're saying. So you start in your critique here by, are you denying climate change?
I'm denying climate stasis, that the climate was ever the same. No, I'm not
denying.
Of course. What we have is CO2 is a greenhouse gas. I don't know of any of the climate skeptics that you ran against that deny that. But the question is,
I'm not ranting.
Are we on a mild increase in temperature with a significant perturbations naturally over top of that? Which recently it seems like that's what's happening. We've had 12 hot years, but that's been flat. We haven't had increasingly hot, and that's what the models don't predict. And everybody on both sides of the climate debate is recognizing that it's causing trouble for people because their models aren't predicting this, and they're ratcheting back the estimates of the likelihood of these very hot futures.
So your critique of this says, A, it's going to hurt the economy because energy prices will go up, and B, it's not necessary because you don't see damaging climate change coming.
I see two things. It doesn't look like there's a catastrophe coming, but even if there were a catastrophe coming, doing all of this will have negligible impact on temperature. We could have done cap and trade, and we could have had all the developed countries do cap and trade the same amount, and it would have moderated temperatures in a century by about 0.4 degrees.
Joe Rome, there's nothing we can do.
Well, I'm surprised that we'd be hearing climate denial at this late stage.
Denial.
As the president said, you know, we don't have time for the flat earth society. The fact is, you know, tell the people devastated by Hurricane Sandy that increased sea levels didn't help create the worst storm surge in New York City and northern New Jersey history. And try to tell the people in the West who are suffering from record drought that the increased heat is not making the drought worse. You know, yesterday was 91 degrees Fahrenheit in Fairbanks. So you know, I think we're seeing greater extreme weather. We're seeing greater deluges, which is what we expect. Wet areas get wetter because we're putting more water vapor into the atmosphere, and what goes up must come down. Dry areas get drier because when you get hotter, you dry up the ground, and it dries out the soils, and that's why we've been in this devastating drought, particularly in the West, which the climate models had predicted. And then if you look in the Arctic, as the president said, we've had an incredibly sharp loss of Arctic ice. And there's a lot of new science that suggests that the loss of Arctic ice weakens the jet stream and, in fact, makes weather more extreme in this country. So I think we need to get past the notion that climate change is not a severe threat. From the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to the top scientists in the world, everyone has said if we keep doing nothing on climate, we're going to see catastrophic impacts.
Joe, what about the negligible impact argument that David Kreutzer is making here, saying even if you do all this, even if you would have done much of what has been proposed in the past, you would have a negligible impact on the climate trend? What about it, Joe?
Well, that's a very strange argument to make, because for a long time, conservatives have been saying, well, we can't act until other countries act. The fact is that the president said before the international climate negotiations in Copenhagen in 2009, the president said we are going to reduce emissions 17%. And there was a tentative deal put in place. But the fact of the matter is, if the richest country in the world, the country responsible for the most cumulative pollution, can't come to the negotiating table with a modest commitment, then you can't expect a global deal. The Chinese are already putting in place some carbon controls. The Europeans have been putting in carbon controls for a long time. So I think the point is we need to lead here to create a global deal. Obviously, if you just look at U.S. emissions reductions, it's not going to have a big impact. The U.S. emissions reductions are critical to enable a global treaty that offers some chance to our grandchildren and beyond, that we're not going to leave them a destroyed climate. And so, you know, we have no choice but to act. And this is, the choice the president has been left by conservatives.
Coral Davenport, do you see these steps, if they're taken, as changing the dynamic around international negotiations on climate change and emissions? Does this give the U.S. leverage to encourage China, India, you name it, to be more bold in their own steps? Or, are we behind at this point?
I think this fundamentally changes the dynamic in the global effort towards reaching a climate change treaty. Joe Rahm mentioned Copenhagen. I remember talking to a Chinese negotiator there who talked about how President Obama and John Kerry were there making pledges that the U.S. was going to act on climate. Their pledge depended on the Senate acting. Essentially, they were promising that the Senate was going to act. And the Chinese negotiator, through a translator, said, I don't think Harry Reid is ever going to get the 60 votes he needs for that bill. Amazing that the rest of the world, Harry Reid, the Senate majority leader, the rest of the world is very aware that the U.S. hasn't been acting because it's depended on Congress. And President Obama and U.S. negotiators, can't rely. Their pledges can't be trusted because they depend on a Congress that hasn't acted on climate. This time, this really changes that dynamic. The negotiators can go and say, it's done. It's done by executive mandate. We don't have to wait on Congress. Here is the action. It's top down. And I think it really changes the U.S. position. Usually the U.S. has kind of gone into the room, demanded that other countries act, but not had something to show for itself. This, I think, can turn the U.S. into a leader with a concrete piece of action and can give the U.S. The leverage that it needs to demand action from China and India.
We'll see. They can say it's done. The courts may have something to say about that. We're talking 2017 before a bunch of this comes into effect. But it's a big stake in the ground by the president yesterday. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Don in Whetstone, Kentucky is calling. Don, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, man. Well, apparently now we have a king, I live in East Kentucky. I work in Harlan County.
Coal country.
That's all we do here. Okay?
Yep.
And we've all been dreading this speech and this mandate from President Obama since he's been in office, really. And all he did yesterday, really, was just guarantee a bunch of boys lost their job. That's all he did. And the comment the lady made earlier on about this shift from coal to natural gas and how we might be able to find jobs there, what are we going to do, trade $60,000 a year digging coal so we can slap up drywall and a new natural gas plant for a year as a contractor?
I mean, maybe somebody's going to be moving to North Dakota to frack. I don't know, Don.
They are. It'll be a great migration yet again, mandated by one fella.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's ridiculous.
What about the concern, and you've heard it described about the climate, Don?
The kids, the future, I'm all about the kids. I got two of my own. That's all I'm about. Nothing I wouldn't do for them. You know what I got to do first? I got to feed them. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
I have a job to feed the kids, man.
Don, we hear it loud and clear from Whetstone. Joe Rome, what do you say to Don? He and his mates, they've got jobs in coal.
Well, I think there's no question that the single most important thing we have to do is think about our children. The fact of the matter
is... What about Don's children?
The coal industry has been suffering primarily because of improved productivity in the coal industry. I think it's quite safe to say that there actually hasn't even been a loss of jobs under the president in the coal industry. But look, the industry, the president is not acting as a king. He is acting as a responsible father and president in ensuring the health and safety of Americans today, our children, our grandchildren, and into the future.
Let's grant that, but think for a minute about economic displacement here, because these things don't come without their own kind of economic consequences. What about it? Does this effectively ask guys like Don to move to, you know, the Dakotas, or is there anything in this program that would help those who are displaced by its steps?
Well, let's... In the bill that the conservatives killed, that would have had a considerable amount of money, not only for helping workers that would be displaced by this, but it was actually had a tremendous amount of incentives for trying to develop and deploy technology where you had a coal plant and you would capture the carbon and store it under the ground. The conservatives killed that. They really left the president no choice whatsoever.
David Kreutzer, let me come to you. Was that a mistake?
I think it
was the whole bill. So, you know, Joe's picking out and saying, well, they killed this part of it.
Yeah,
it might have been important to our caller. All that money from cap and trade was divvied up. 97% of it was handed out to a whole bunch of special interests. It was a feeding frenzy of special interests when they were doing that. So it was a good bill to kill.
Is coal a special interest?
Is our caller a special interest
in
coal country?
It can be.
Well,
so you're saying we should let the coal industry go, and I was trying to
preserve
the coal industry.
No, we should let the coal industry work in the market. We shouldn't tax other people to transfer money to any particular industry.
Do you think this is going to lead to more U.S. leverage to get the rest of the world to come along on cleaning up to avoid climate change, David?
I don't think that's a good strategy. And we can look at the rest of the world and we can see what they've done. You know, Spain was supposedly a model with their solar and wind energy. They have backed off because it's really done damage to their economy. Germany can't integrate all of the solar that they've had, so they've dramatically ratcheted back their subsidies. You know, we keep hearing about China. China has quit reporting their CO2 emissions because they were so big. You know, people say, well, they have some windmills here, some solar panels there. China is interested in having jobs for their workers, not in meeting some sort of climate deal that makes people in D.C. happy.
Though we have seen them put a lot into alternative energy, that's part of this program. We're talking this hour about the president's new push on climate change, what he's proposing, where it might take us. The president's saying he wants to use executive authority to get new regulations out there, saying that the economy will respond. Here he is at Georgetown University saying the U.S. economy, the U.S. business can innovate.
If you look at our history, don't bet against American industry. Don't bet against American workers. Don't tell folks that we have to choose between the health of our children or the health of our economy.
Don't choose, says the president. Lydia in Aiken, South Carolina, what do you think?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been in regulation all of my professional life. Every time there has been a strong environmental regulation, there's also followed innovation, which has cut the cost of those regulations enormously. So when everybody estimates how much it's going to cost to do this, they are wrong because they're not taking into account the fact that we do innovate. The U.S. is the most innovative country in the world. Also, we will provide leadership, and we will also send out our innovations, and other countries will pay for them. We are losing our leadership in these innovative technologies because we're not focusing on the possibilities that this country can achieve.
Lydia, I appreciate your call. David Kreutzer, what about Lydia's argument? And I guess the presence we heard there before hers, make the regulations, do what we need to for the climate, and U.S. industry will innovate and thrive. What do you say to that, David?
I don't know about the thrive part. Certainly they'll innovate. I mean, we innovated and got through World War II. That doesn't mean it was a good thing or that we'd want to impose it on ourselves. But I take exception with her saying that these models don't take into account innovation. They do. When prices go up, people respond in a whole bunch of different ways, a lot of innovative ways. That gets built into the economic models. We're using the one that the Obama administration was developed at their Energy Information Administration. We've used it at Heritage. They didn't use it, so we call it the Heritage Energy Model. And you know, it shows, yeah, there's innovation. Yeah, there'll be some more gas when we kill coal, but not enough to make up the difference. And the price will go up significantly, which has a very bad impact on manufacturing. So, you know, you're going to lose jobs. And then we get back to the question, what does this do? All right, this program, even if everybody else does come along, China and India aren't, so that's a dream world. But if the developed world comes along, it only moderates temperatures at the high end by less than a half a degree. Probably not that much if we're looking at the new estimates of the sensitivity of climate to CO2.
So what? Sit tight? Are you saying sort of steady as she goes, burn the coal, pump the CO2, and we'll be fine?
Yeah, okay. Let's also be clear. CO2 is not soot and it's not toxic.
Coal is not clean.
Coal has some other things, and we regulate those. You know, we see the economy getting more efficient with regards to energy. So we see the improvement in terms of how much GDP we generate for a certain amount of energy and CO2. That's already getting better. We're shifting some to natural gas. But this is going to have a cost, and the cost isn't today and the benefit for our grandchildren. You look at any of these models, you look at any of the things, the costs get greater down the road. As you pull the energy out of the economy, as you make the consumers go to higher and higher cost sources of the energy, it gets more expensive for our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren.
But what about the cost of inactivity there? I mean, I hear that you're saying don't worry so much about it, it's exaggerated, but you know, a whole lot of scientists flatly disagree.
No, but what's the cost of inactivity? It's not the total cost of whatever warming there might be. We have to look at how much do we moderate the warming compared to how much it costs to moderate the warming. And it's possible, in fact, I think it's true, that the cost is greater than the benefits of the moderation.
Joe Rome, not worth it. Not worth it, Joe.
Well, it's surprising in this day and age that someone like David would be arguing that doing nothing is the best solution to our climate problem. The world's top climate scientists, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, anybody who has independently looked at this has said, if we don't act, we are facing planetary warming, global warming of 10 degrees Fahrenheit or more. We could see a third of the habited land of the world turned into a dust bowl. We're going to see sea level rise that could be 3, 4, 5, or 6 feet by the end of the century, which is going to wipe out places like Miami and New Orleans and the coastal properties of the United States. So it is absurd, and I think I will argue, as the president did, immoral to contemplate inaction. The question is, what kind of action should we take? In a perfect world, I think we would have had a well-designed climate bill, but conservatives and people like David helped argue against it and killed it. This leaves the president no choice. People need to remember that the Supreme Court ordered the EPA to regulate carbon pollution if they found that carbon pollution was harmful to human health and welfare, because that's what the Clean Air Act says you have to do. So, in fact, the administration is merely following what the Supreme Court ordered it to do. And I think that what the president put on the table is the very least that he could do. And obviously, China and India have been hiding behind our inaction. It's only because the U.S. has refused to act that those countries have been able to stand up in the world and say, well, look, the United States isn't acting, so they're rich. Why should we act? Mm. We're not as rich as they are. So it is a first step. It is a I think, prudent act, but it is the only thing we can do if we're concerned about our children and grandchildren.
Michelle in Hampton, Virginia. Michelle, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thank you for your show.
Mm-hmm.
I was just, I'm 100% behind President Obama trying to, you know, have an honest conversation, though difficult, about this subject. It concerns me that a lot of the topic today revolves around the great panacea being natural gas fracking, which is, you know, still cracking the earth apart, trying to extract every last drop of fossil fuel out of it. When I do believe that if there was a mandate set for what so far in this show has been kind of a token or throwaway to solar and wind as a side comment, you know, it's always all renewable energies like solar and wind, that solar and wind are being kept, particularly solar, being kept at a level that they cannot innovate and take off. And if the president had a mandate in this country for even just government institutions being fueled by solar and wind, that's got to be an enormous amount of energy consumption.
Go to renewables, you say, Michelle, and we've got it. Coral, what is in this package when it comes to renewables? How significant is the push on that front, or not significant, Coral?
It essentially keeps on a path that this administration has been going on already, which is just opening up public lands for development of renewable energy. So that we'll see more renewable energy on public lands. That's not going to be enough to truly scale up solar and wind. I mean, right now, solar and wind are less than 5% of the U.S. electricity mix. What we may see is solar and renewables responding to a market signal. If these regulations are actually put in place, and, you know, coal does start going offline or becoming more expensive, there's a shift to natural gas is expensive. There may be a market shift pushing more towards renewables. One of the biggest challenges for solar and wind is that right now they are more expensive in most markets than coal and natural gas. If we see a shift where they have what's called kind of grid parity, which basically means that it costs the same to get electricity from solar than it does from fossil fuels, then we'll see electric utilities choosing to invest in solar and wind. But the real scale up of those sources is, you know, probably going to be driven by market forces. If this regulation survives all the legal challenges and actually gets implemented, it will probably have it will help push the market in that direction.
A lot of response online. TF says, thinking about coal and coal miners, it says, remember, the future of coal mining is mountaintop removal, which our listener says provides fewer mining jobs in West Virginia than florists do. I don't know about that. Maybe. I don't know. David says we certainly can't point the finger at China and other countries while we continue to pump soot into the sky. Ron in Middleborough, Massachusetts is calling. Ron, you're on the air.
Yes. Thank you, Tom. Appreciate the opportunity to voice my opinion.
Sure.
You know, Mother Nature and our Earth is a wonderful, wonderful force in the universe, and it has the great power to regulate itself over time. And I personally don't believe that there's a global warming problem. It may be temporary, but it's going to change, balance out, and the Earth will, in its infinite universal capability, regulate itself. And
What about us in that balance, Ron? Not to mention other species. Maybe it snuffs us out to balance. I mean, what does that balance mean? Balance can be pretty rough, can't it?
Well, I mean, if you think about the dinosaur period when we had volcanoes and, you know, very warm temperatures, you know, the Earth eventually balanced itself out.
Dinosaurs gone. So what's your concern more immediately then?
My concern is the cost on the economy.
Yep.
You know, with these kinds of government interventions into the market, it's going to create additional costs on the taxpayer, the American people, and the businesses that depend on coal and the generation of electricity to provide their goods and services. And, you know, my take is that, you know, these Fabian socialist initiatives are not going to work. And they're very expensive. And one of your speakers here mentioned the IMF and the World Bank and the Federal Reserve. These, you know, that's all the same group of people in my mind.
Ron, we got it. I don't know what's socialist about it, but I hear your concern on the economy, and I can understand how you might have it. We're looking at President Obama's big new package. on climate change and carbon emissions and where it might take us. Joe Rome, take that straight on. People have been through rough economic times. They look ahead and they don't want more rough times. And they, you know, many legitimately worry about the economic cost of addressing. Even our caller Ron sees it as a serious problem, big enough to wipe out the dinosaurs in the parallel he draws there. Who knows if we're on the line, but what about the economic cost?
Well, I think you played the clip from the president in which he said, you know, I wouldn't bet against American people or American businesses. Every time we've heard that we couldn't do this, we couldn't have more fuel-efficient vehicles, we couldn't take lead out of gasoline, we couldn't save the ozone layer, it all turned out that once you set the target to help preserve public health, that businesses not only were able to do this much cheaply than anyone thought, but we've been able to export some of those technologies overseas. I think the question is, do we have to take action to preserve a livable climate for our children and grandchildren? Once you understand that the answer is yes, as the president does, then it's important for us to act as quickly as possible so that we can be the leader in creating the technologies that reduce carbon pollution. And I am a big supporter of solar and wind and energy efficiency, and I think those will play an increasingly large role. You know, the cost of solar has come down 80% in the past 10 to 15 years, really astonishing improvements in technology. And I expect that it's going to come down another 50% over the next several years as we keep pushing more technology in the marketplace.
David Kreutzer, what about that argument, U.S. left behind if we don't innovate here? What do you expect in terms of economic
impact? We don't want to be the first lemming over the cliff. And that's, you know, being a leader sometimes good, sometimes it isn't. The market has been very responsive and has developed a lot of leadership. The federal government doesn't have a great track record of that. So what really stuns me, though, is that we can put this huge cost on the economy, and Joe and the president say that the American innovation will take care of it, but we're totally helpless if in 100 years the Earth warms up by 2 degrees. So instead of having a 95-degree day, which is already hot, we have a 97-degree day. Why can't we adapt to that with all of our ingenuity?
I mean, you know, when your city is underwater, it's hard to adapt, I guess.
Yeah, but that's a total exaggeration. Joe says, you know, people. He says they're flat. We've seen it before. We saw it 100 years ago. We saw it 200 years ago. We've had hurricanes for ages and ages. There's no trend in more of this. The sea level rise is not going to go up by 6 feet. Joe is simply lying when he says all the top scientists agree with him.
That's inappropriate for you.
No, it's not inappropriate. You look at it.
Anyone can go to my blog, Climate Progress, and read the science. The scientific literature says if we keep doing nothing, 5 and 6 feet are perfectly likely outcomes this century. And by the way,
that's an outlier.
Sea levels
that's an
keep
outlier.
Rising.
You can find somebody that says that.
Read the science. We'll leave it to the science on that front, and we're for it. One more piece here from Obama on the Keystone Pipeline. I want to get in a little interpretation before we're out of here. Keystone, here's the president.
Allowing the Keystone Pipeline to be built requires a finding that doing so would be in our nation's interest. And our national interest will be served only if this project does not significantly exacerbate the problem of carbon pollution. The net effects of the pipeline's impact, on our climate will be absolutely critical to determining whether this project is allowed to go forward. It's relevant.
Coral Davenport, is that a thumbs up or a thumbs down? Which way does that lean?
You know, I read, someone wrote on Twitter that his language on the Keystone Pipeline was so wide open you could put a pipeline through it. Was that Joe
no
or
less.
David?
No less, okay.
At any rate, it is very hard to interpret that. I think he kind of put it out there to set himself up for whatever he's going to do, because what the president said is we won't approve the pipeline. If the environmental impact study shows that it would contribute to significantly more emissions. As it happens, the draft environmental impact study of the pipeline says it won't significantly increase emissions. And so while I would be loath to try to directly interpret exactly what the president's going to do. I can tell you that the broad read on what comes next and also the political purpose of this big speech was kind of to the thought is that this speech was about setting the president up to show he's taking action on climate so that in a month or two he can approve the Keystone Pipeline and not get attacked by his base. I don't know if that's what they're going to do, but that's the thought.
There's a reading of the tea leaves on a big speech. We'll see what actually unfolds here. Coral Davenport with National Journal, we're grateful to you for being with us this hour. Thank you, Coral, for your time.
Oh, thank you so much. It was great to be here.
David Kreutzer at the Heritage Foundation, Research Fellow in Energy Economics and Climate Change there. David Kreutzer, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Joe Rome with the Climate Progress blog. Thank you, Joe. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.